are listening to the Elephant in the Room podcast with your host, Sutta Singh. Each week, we will bring you a diverse range of inspiring speakers on issues of inequality and inequity. You will hear stories about fairness, justice, belonging, and about best practice for creating a more inclusive workplace. So, if you are an individual or leader interested in a fairer, equitable, compassionate society and workplace, this podcast is for you.
My guest on this episode of the Elephant in the Room podcast is Pooja Sachdev, author of Rewire, A Radical Approach to Diversity and Difference. She is also a business psychologist and advises organizations on culture, leadership, and diversity. Hi, Pooja. Welcome to the Elephant in the Room podcast. It's lovely to have you here today. To start, tell us a bit more about your journey, your childhood, culture, education, and how you came to be where you are today.
Yeah. Sure. Thank you very much for having me, Sudha. It's a pleasure to be here. So my journey, I guess, like a lot of people these days, hasn't been a straight line. I see myself, I suppose, as a mix of identities. I've moved countries twice. I've lived in very different parts of the world. As you know, I was born in India. I moved to the States as a teenager to study in Wisconsin. I went to college there for 4 years, and then I moved to London in 1999. So I've been here a very long time, and I very much see myself as a Londoner. But in my heart, I guess there's a dual home. It's Mumbai and London. And I still have very strong ties with India. I have a sense of roots there. So I don't know if you had that experience, but you know, you get to that point where you've actually lived away from your country of birth Yes. longer than you live there. So I've been here over 20 years. So, you know, at that point, you have to, I guess, psychologically, you shift a little bit and you create an identity for yourself that's a mixture of the different geographies that have influenced you. So I suppose, like a lot of other people, I've got a mixed view of how I see myself, and I've kind of journeyed through these three continents through the course of my life. So that's the kind of the personal side. On the professional side, I guess my background is in psychology. I studied psychology and education in the States. Initially, I wanted to be a teacher. But when I came to the UK, I realized that I would have to retrain to teach here. So I couldn't afford to that stage. So I took the first job I could get, and I ended up working in market research, moved to employee research. And finally, I got really interested in the human side of business and human psychology. What makes us happy at work? What drives motivation? The meaning of work and fulfillment? So I ended up doing a master's in occupational psychology. And my work right now is very broadly in the organizational development space. And in between all of that, I also trained as a counselor, as a psychotherapist. So these are the different kind of, wow, I guess, milestones in my career journey. And all of those influence the work that I do now.
Absolutely. I can understand a lot of that, having different identities. Just thinking about who you are, I guess there is some angst always in there, but it makes for a richer sort of experience, hopefully.
Yeah. And I think you tend to take a different lens on the world when you've got a mixture of identities within you, and you've kind of moved countries. And, you know, also, and it's the same within my career. Like in every piece of work that I do, I have a kind of a counseling human psychology lens, but I also have a research and evidence lens, as well as the business psychology. So I think it does enrich you personally and professionally to have that, you know, like kaleidoscope view.
That's amazing. What prompted you to write Rewire?
So the very first line in the book is, this book was born out of frustration. And that's really true. I didn't set out to become any kind of diversity specialist, but in all my time working, especially on the consultancy side, I often got pulled into, you know, the D&I projects, the ad hoc D&I stuff that we got from clients, whether it was, you know, a survey on well-being, or, you know, creating a new question on race or ethnicity. And as I was drawn into this work and I got a glimpse of how it was being dealt with, I started to get more and more frustrated with how much conversation and how much money and time was being spent on it, but so little progress was being seen. So I'm not saying no progress, but, you know, we are seeing small percentage shifts here and there, and those are to be celebrated. But essentially, things didn't feel radically different, right? And the conversations that we seemed to be having were very much the same as kind of 10 years before that. And even before that, when I was in college, thinking back to, you know, papers that we have written on affirmative action or whatever, you know, arguing the ethics around that. And you think we're still really having the same conversations, just in different words. So I thought there's got to be like a better way of doing this that really, like the way we're seeing change in other areas, like in technology and in other aspects of business, there's got to be a better way to deal with this issue that is more strategic and where we see change, sustainable change.
I agree with you on that point. Every decade, we come back to this conversation. I was working on gender diversity 20 years ago, and we were talking about women on boards, about supplier diversity, about how do we enable women to break the glass ceiling. And then in 2020 and 2021, we're still talking about these same things, and progress has been so slow. And that's a very interesting point that you mentioned, that why do we not look at it in the same way as we look at new technology that an organization needs to adopt in order to move forward? That's a very interesting thing. What is the essential premise behind Rewire?
So the basic message is that diversity and inclusion is not just about piecemeal, tick box, simplistic procedural things like policies or numbers. It's about a much bigger issue. It's about mindset and it's about culture. It's deeply personal and individual, but it's also systemic. So in order to see sustainable change, we have to take that systemic view. So what I mean by that is there's no point, for example, you know, just making a tactical list and doing, for example, putting an equal ops statement on your website or writing a new flex working policy if the mindset of the people within the organization is not aligned with it. And there's no point setting targets or quotas. You know, we have lots of discussions around targets and quotas, but just setting targets and quotas for certain groups of people isn't enough unless you also work on the environmental factors that will enable those groups to succeed and thrive. So I used to work in the travel industry back in my early days in this country. And so this phrase always stuck with me, you know, there's no point just putting bums on seats. You have to make the experience good for those people. Otherwise, they're not going to be repeat customers, right? So the same is true for organizations. So I guess to sum up the basic premise behind Rewire, it is that if we want to see sustainable change in diversity and inclusion, and if we genuinely are working towards it, then we have to take a broader, a braver, a more systemic approach, and we have to tackle culture and mindset.
Those are things that we never really address because culture is pervasive and it is insidious. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, it's difficult to actually pinpoint it. You've written about six lenses that describe a range of social, psychological, and organizational theories and factors that influence how we think, feel, and relate to each other, how groups operate, and how diversity and inclusion plays out at work. Can you say more about that?
Sure. Yeah. And in fact, that probably answers your question about culture being insidious and hard to kind of pinpoint, because that's where we started writing this book. And we said, you know, the basic message is, yes, it should be about culture and mindset. We need to think holistically. We need to look at the system. But then we stopped and we said, well, what do we mean by culture? What is culture? And how do we get there? How do we get an understanding of what drives culture within organizations to the point where we can start to change it? So in all the research that we did over the couple of years, we started pulling together different factors that we believed influence organizational culture. And we organized it into six broad themes. And this is what we've called the six lenses in the book. So these six themes, three of them are personal. So they're individual factors. For example, our personal identity. And, you know, we were talking earlier about complex identity and how that identity shapes who we think we are and the decisions that we make and the way we see the world. So it's a lens with which we view the world. Similarly, there are cognitive processes. So the way our brains work, that puts another lens on how we make decisions and judgments about things we see. So in this way, we've kind of mapped out six lenses, three personal and three are organizational. So organizational ones being, for example, the origins and history of the organization, who the founders were, who are the leaders, how leadership is defined, the external context within which the organization operates. And all these six factors influence the thoughts, decisions, and actions that we might take in any given moment. And our collective thoughts, decisions, and actions is ultimately how our culture manifests. So the six lenses are sort of the six drivers of organizational culture or organizational behavior in a way.
Do you think organizations are intimidated by the thought of working through these six lenses? Because mostly businesses are about, you know, hard numbers and facts. Yeah. And here you have something that goes beyond numbers.
Yeah, and I think there is a problem because you don't end up with a neat formula. Even if you do take a look at the six lenses, and most organizations don't, you're not going to end up with a very simple, easy-to-use formula. And I think that's part of the challenge with this work. You just kind of have to accept that there is complexity. Organizations are groups of human beings at the end of the day. So even if you do kind of put metrics and formulas in place, it's never going to be an exact science. And I suppose there are other areas within organizational work where we do have a behavioral view, and it's, for example, in learning and development, and it's not always kind of based on specific metrics, but these are the themes, and these help to give you a rounded picture of what might be going on within the organization. So it helps you to, for example, I use this as a starting point in a lot of my consulting work because it gives you a framework for where there might be gaps or blind spots, so things you might have missed in terms of your self-knowledge as an organization.
Do you think organizations are taking in these six lenses into consideration? In your experience, the people you worked with or you've heard anecdotally about?
Yeah, I think only partially. I would say that organizations tend to be a lot more outer-focused in this respect. So what I mean by that is that they often have a much deeper understanding of their customers, so how their customers think, they have customer segmentation, what customer behavior is, what the market is doing. And so they have a much deeper in-depth knowledge of customers than they do of their employees. So the inward awareness tends to be a little bit lower in general. Not true for all organizations, but broadly speaking, I think the focus tends to often be outward. Now, we do have, you know, employee surveys, and of course, we do employee research. So we have some knowledge. But what I think is that that doesn't always go deep enough. So in all organizations, there are unspoken norms and practices, how things are done. You've been there a little while, you kind of figure this stuff out, you know, you figure out who makes decisions and who has power and how to get things done. We all kind of hold this implicit knowledge, but it's rare to see this knowledge become explicit. And I think this is where the power is. This is where we can kind of shift things, because that's really how things get done, right? So it doesn't matter what policies you have in place. Ultimately, everyone kind of knows this is how you navigate the organization. This is how decisions you get. This is how you see, you know, this is who you need to speak to see things shift. So even where we have organizations might have a cultural or have value statements maybe on their website, that is normally the polished version, I would say, of how the operation works. So they say, we are this, or we believe this. You know, I still think there might be elements of truth in that, but it is a polished version. It is essentially the employer brand, and that isn't always completely aligned with the actual experience or ways of working. So I think that's the level that we need to reflect on a little bit more. We need to truly try to understand if we want to shift things and create change in this area.
Very, very interesting. There is a reference in your book to HR as poachers turned gamekeepers. What, according to you, is the role of HR in enabling culture change? Actually, on the first part, I'd also like to, you know, add that we've seen in the recent past, in the past year, how HR has taken sort of charge of the diversity agenda and even on hiring on diversity and where it sits within the organization.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I always get picked up on that phrase. I mean, obviously, it stands out for people who read the book. And I know that I have a slightly contentious view about the role of HR in driving the D&I agenda. And I also know that that's where D&I mostly sits in organizations. So this, if I keep talking like this, I am going to put myself at risk of losing my job. But, you know, I often say this, and this is not a criticism of HR. I consider myself to be an HR professional as well. But the few instances where I've seen real change or big leaps in D&I has been where it has been taken out of the HR function. So I don't know. I think there are a number of reasons for this, and I don't think it's a simple solution. But the role of HR has always been, in my mind, a little bit problematic. There's an inherent conflict of interest, if you want to put it that way, about what the role of HR is there, whether it's there to protect the organization or to protect the individuals. So I know it's kind of the same thing because, you know, the group of individuals makes up the organization. People don't always see it like that when they're in there. Yeah. So I've had many conversations with colleagues in HR over the years where people talk about HR professionals almost hitting a personal identity crisis at some point in their career, because the people who join HR and want to work in HR are often people who care about other people, you know, and have that instinct to look after others. And when you end up working in HR for a long time, you find yourself doing work that isn't always aligned with that value. So it becomes a little bit of an internal conflict in terms of the role of HR and what you're there to do and who you're there to serve. And then there's also the operational side, right? So HR traditionally is there to create and institute policies and processes around people. So those are the tools we have in HR, and that's what we tend to default to. So yeah. Often an issue that's as complex as this, that's about mindset and it's about culture, we are too quick to operationalize it. We jump to a tactical solution before we have a clear vision or a strategic overview of what we are trying to do and looking at the different aspects of it. So we are not traditionally very good at taking that strategic overview and having that vision within HR. We jump straight to kind of what's the solution. And that doesn't always serve us well. And I suppose the final thing to say on HR is, yes, HR is responsible for creating the policies around people, but ultimately, diversity and inclusion isn't just an HR thing. It manifests in all the little interactions that we have at work, all the micro decisions that we make every day. And HR is not there in all those everyday moments. So ultimately, it should be something that is seen to be everybody's job. It has to be weaved into what we all do as an organization. It has to be core to how we work, you know. And I think often when it's kind of put into the HR bucket, it's kind of then, you know, as if like the responsibility is passed on to HR and they will deal with that and we will just carry on doing what we always did, you know, and it shouldn't be like that. I think it needs to be everybody's job, not just HR.
Is there someone who should be driving it within the organization, and should it be the leadership C-suite that should be doing this?
Of course, I think that, right? I mean, I would say that, but I do think that there is power where there has been a role that either reports into the CEO, or the CEO has taken it within their remit. That's where you really kind of see the fundamental shifts happening. So yes, I do think it should be something central that's kind of weaved into the overall strategy of the organization. And then it seeps into kind of everybody's role.
COVID-19 and Black Lives Matter seem to have focused the minds of leaders on racial inequalities. Do you think these are short-term measures to ride the storm? What is different from before? We were just discussing before the start of the podcast that things don't change, and we seem to be coming back to these discussions and these debates again and again.
I mean, I think there's a mixture. So initially, when we looked at some of the instantaneous responses by individuals and organizations, particularly on social media, the statements that were being made, the big donations that were just suddenly being handed out, the pledges, I would classify them as knee-jerk reactions. And I was, to be honest, a little skeptical about a lot of them. And the reason for that is because I felt people were responding to a PR crisis rather than an actual crisis, right? So they were responding in crisis mode. And what worries me about responding in crisis mode is that what we tend to do as individuals or as organizations in crisis mode is to do what we have to do to deflect the issue. So you tend to take on the band-aid solution, make that big statement just quickly. You just want this crisis to go where you want it to stop. So you push the problem out. So an example of that is the big, you know, flurry of diversity and inclusion roles that have now cropped up. Right? I've never seen so many. In a way, of course, it's good that these roles are coming up and organizations are doing something about it. But on the other hand, if I was taking on one of those roles, I'd be a little bit nervous because you're taking on, in a way, the conscience of the whole organization, right? This, you know, the problem is being put on your shoulders to deal with. And what I don't want to see is that, okay, we've appointed a D&I person, they'll take this on for us, phew, and the rest of us can just kind of go back to, you know, normal and keep doing what we did. And that person or that team is now going to just, you know, take care of this issue for us. But having said that, I have also seen in the last few months and more recent months and weeks, some organizations that are getting to the point of having ridden the kind of the crisis reaction have kind of slowed down and are now responding thoughtfully and strategically and are thinking long term. So that's very rewarding to see because it's been a painful process. And obviously, this has opened up conversations that have needed to happen for a long time. So I'm very happy to see that there are companies that are truly taking on the challenge in a genuine way. And, it is different. I mean, if you think about the protests and if you think about, you know, social media and you think about the time we're in with COVID being in the house, this is a very unique time.
So what would you say? I mean, so the CDOs are still being appointed. So what would you say the CDO's role actually is in the organization at this point?
I've said to some of our kind of client organizations as well. It's kind of moving from crisis mentality to action planning. This feels very urgent. This feels huge. This feels all consuming. But it's been huge and it's been urgent for decades. So whether you kind of rush and train all your employees in this workshop next week, or if you do it in a couple of weeks' time and you give some more thought to it, or in a couple of months' time, it's probably not going to make the difference. What's going to make the difference is being thoughtful about what kind of workshop it is, who goes to it, what's really going to work. So I'd rather you do it slowly and properly than just do put those band-aid solutions and knee-jerk reactions in place and basically do diversity and inclusion work that is built to make you look good, that is built to protect your reputation. I'd rather see you do good work that is built to create greater fairness, you know?
That makes a lot of sense. This is our final question. What, according to you, are the three things that organizations can do or should do to be more inclusive?
So, you know, I was actually just reading an article the other day. It was either McKinsey or Harvard Business, one of those anyway, that said key steps organizations need to take to embrace D&I, or it was something like how to turn empathy into action. And so there are these lists in a lot of places, right? They're everywhere. Yeah. I myself wrote an article entitled What You Can Do Now. So there are these lists out there and they're very kind of driven by tactical solutions. So for example, they might include kind of measurement and setting targets and things that you might put into an action plan. So what I'll do is I won't go in that direction to answer your question because I think that's there. That's out there already. Just Google, you know, D&I best practice. I'll answer it slightly differently. So for me, organizations first need to take a step back and reflect on what is driving this agenda for them. What is the why? And the why again, and the why again. And what is the why now? Why are we doing this now? And I think if you really get to an honest place of being able to answer what your purpose is, what your intention is, that will drive the actions that you take. And the actions will be genuine and meaningful, and they will hit at the right case. And when I say why, I don't just mean the business case. I mean the genuine human purpose, right? So that's probably my number one, is to start with purpose, focus on intent, and hook everything into the deeper why. That's built on a collective aspiration, not just a shallow business case. It's something that engages the whole organization. The second I would probably say is resilience. So accepting that this is complex, you know, so taking a growth mindset to it, allowing spaces for conversations that might be difficult, that might not always work perfectly the first time, allowing space for listening, learning from each other for growth. So for example, understanding intersectionality, we know that there are no simple binaries. We know there are no silver bullets. So we have to kind of just look at the bigger picture and take a growth mindset with this, you know, accepting that there is uncertainty within this process. So being resilient with that. And then finally, I would say stamina and playing the long game, not band-aid. So this is, you know, to be honest, it's a lifelong journey. Whether you're an individual or an organization looking to become more inclusive, this is a lifelong journey that we choose to embark on. You know, there might be goals that you'll set. There might be milestones and markers of progress, but there is no real endpoint. Organizations are ultimately groups of human beings, and human beings will always have human failing. So what we commit to is a continuous process of reflecting on ourselves and trying to be the best we can be and the fairest we can be in a way that is authentic. So those would be my three.
Fantastic 3 points. It's purpose with intent, it is resilience, and it is stamina. And definitely people, organizations have to look at the long game, but there has to be some change within a certain period of time to show that people are being treated differently from what they were earlier. Thank you so much, Pooja, for your time. And I've really enjoyed your insights, and I'm sure all the listeners will too.
Thank you very much for having me. It's really been a pleasure to talk to you, Sudha.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Elephant in the Room podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on any of your favorite platforms, iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts. And if you enjoyed listening to the podcast today, don't forget to write a review and tell your friends. Sign up on the link in the show notes to receive updates on our guest speakers, blogs, and events. And don't forget to tune in every Thursday for new episodes.